Welcome to the Leadership Show. If there was a time for conscious leadership, that time is now more than ever. The Industrial Revolution undeniably shaped the modern world. It gave rise to incredible advancements and progress, but also left us with unintended consequences. Sustainability wasn't part of the conversation, whether by oversight or by design. And now we face the challenge of maintaining the modern world we've created. Today, we stand at the dawn of a new era, the sustainable revolution. This revolution calls on conscious leaders, leaders who understand that our future lies in creating shared value for the planet, people, and of course, profit. This is what we refer to as conscious capitalism. In these episodes, we will be unpacking the essence of leadership for a sustainable future. We'll have critical discussions on how we as leaders can move beyond short-term thinking and focus on the core principles that will secure a future that is resilient, inclusive, and sustainable. Join us as we explore how conscious leadership can drive change, foster innovation, and ensure that the decisions we make today can lead us to a future we all want to live in. Ding Ding, I'm so thrilled to have you here with us today. You and I have been like talking for over 2 months. You have moved to Germany. So tell me about the move. How has that been for you from Singapore to Germany, right?
Yes, correct. I would have expected a bigger culture shock because Singapore being, you know, a metropolitan, millions of people, efficiency, and being the privileged Asian, you know, the Chinese face, and it's a lot of privilege actually in Singapore. But moving back, I feel quite settled because the city I'm moving in, Hanover, is kind of my home away from home. And I grew up, I went to Germany when I was 16 and spent actually most of my corporate senior executive time in Hanover. So 8 years here. And that actually shaped a lot how I positioned myself as an Asian, as a only Asian, only Chinese, only female leader in a very male dominated domain. So I have very good experience actually in living in Germany. So it's good move.
Good for you. So it's like full circle, right?
All right.
So let's get into the meat. I brought you here to the Conscious Leaders podcast specifically to talk about the things that we need to start getting loud about, stepping into our power, the structures that needs to change. And also like these issues that we as women deal with, and I would love to compare notes and to having an understanding as to, you know, we're from South Africa, you are all over the world, actually. You are on a mission to touch over 5 million women's lives through the work that you do, and I really applaud you for all the work that you're doing. I think my starting point for perhaps for the audience for context, so Conscious Leaders is a women in leadership network that we have here in South Africa, and we're all about holistic leadership. It's not just about how you lead in the boardroom, but how do you lead from boardroom to living room? How are you leading from within? How are you leading consciously and in society and being a change agent and really being audacious inside out and leading with tenacity and resilience? And I think for me, what is really fascinating about you is you have a very different view on this. So you talk about, we talk about boardroom to living room, and you're going, I have another theory to add to this. It is from bedroom to boardroom. So I would love for you to elaborate why it is so important for women to pay attention about how they lead in the bedroom. That is quite a fascinating approach.
Yeah, thank you. So the bedroom represents the home and the boardroom represents work. Let's clarify that first. Every time when I say bedroom, otherwise people think about, okay, sex. It's not just about that. It's how you position yourself as an equal partner with, let's assume you are in a heterosexual relationship, how your narrative at home, in the kitchen, in the bedroom, in everywhere else in the house, shapes and forms how you present yourself at work. What I mean by that is usually the first touching point a woman has in your daily life is the heterosexual partner. Let it be your boyfriend, your life partner, your husband, whoever. And often I see more women hitting their wall that they have built at home than they have hit the corporate glass ceiling. And, assuming you have kids or even don't have kids, women still carry majority of the household work. If you have children, majority of the work that you, let's say, pick up the children, the mental load to prepare their food and to study with them and to make sure they are settled, so on and so forth. Even if you don't have children, who wash the dishes, you know, who buy the flowers for home. So the home, the caring, the, you know, the household chore is usually lying on the shoulder of a woman, regardless whether she can be the CEO or she can be the girl who is selling bubble tea outside. This is my experience. And now, with that setting, you go in the moment where you get up in the morning, you go to work, you already start with that setting that, you know, I am the servant because I am you. I prepare the breakfast or I get the kids ready. You are actually in the mindset of serving. And then now you go back to the corporate world and you haven't negotiated your role at home yet. You now go to the corporate world and which, let's be honest, majority of the decision makers are still men. You suddenly need to assert your need or what you want and be a leading them. That switch is not possible for women. So what you have carried on at home, you will carry forward at work. Because if you can't even negotiate your role or what you want in the bedroom or let your husband watch cook the dinner or do the dishes, how can you negotiate with a peer or let alone your boss about your salary, budget, anything? This is where I come from.
I absolutely love that. And in one of your TED Talks, you used the analogy with your husband with his snoring and how he's snoring literally since you've been together, like you've just been okay with it and just like you couldn't get your sleep in and you had to have that tough conversation. Talk to us about that.
So it's a lot of social conditioning. So we have been together and I have always been together with men that snore. And then, you know, when I was much younger and then not even knowing my husband, that then I was talking to my girlfriends and they're like, oh, you know, your earplugs, there are various different of ear clubs and there are what's the time point that you can fall asleep. So you not fall asleep before him or much longer after him or you kick him in the ass. But all the narrative has always been fix yourself, you know, accommodate. And then one day I had the man that I married ultimately, I didn't also think differently. And then it just made me crazy one day, one morning, and then I didn't sleep and I have an important meeting next day and my brain is fully fogged and I was thinking, and we were talking about having children. And I was like, you are actually the biggest kid in the world, you know? I am already trained. I am already trained how to have sleepless night because I have sleepless night every night. And then on the other hand, that I was like, oh my God, now imagine you have a baby. Then you have your snoring husband. That's gonna kill you. You will never survive that. So it's rather out of desperation. I said, you need to do something. And I actually didn't understand. I just said, I'm gonna, what, you know, because I don't know what else I can do. And then we had this conversation and he said, oh, I know it's bad, but is it so bad? Then he actually started to understand what impact it has on me. And then he said, you know, then let me figure out something. And in that moment, it has been so, I don't know, so eye-opening for me because he was willing to do something. And then he was rather surprised that if it is so bad, why do you suffer so long instead of talking me into it? Then I had this conversation with other my girlfriend. They're like, oh, you can ask. Oh, I never thought that my husband should do something. And these are very empowered women. No? I'm not talking about, you know, that these are senior leaders in the corporate world. And then this theory actually then came up is that we are, as women, we always accommodate. And then it become a habit. Then you say yes to a lot of things and you always fix yourself. And then, of course, if you go and the same setting, you are who you are in the bedroom and that person is going to project how you present yourself in any such settings.
It makes so much sense, like when you articulate it that way, and it's like this. I don't know how you feel about this, but I sometimes feel like we think that soft power is sacrifice. You know, kindness means weakness. What is your view on that? Yeah.
This is all the bullshit that have been fed to women. This is what patriarchy has done to us because we believe that shit. And that's what make me the most angry, because that's something we don't even start to challenge, to think, because this is how we are born into it. And I think, you know, talking about emotion or the things, as you said, you know, soft power, empathy, it's... This is what women, let's make it very black and white, majority of women, they are. They want to make sure that others feel good. And we you know, if you're going back to thousands of years, we were in a tribe. We have to be, you know, accommodating, empathetic, and collaborative, because this is how a tribe work. So we support the whole back end. So the friend and the man can be, you know, laser focused, and they hunt the mammoth and then bring the food back home. Now, if you think about the corporate setting or entrepreneur world, any world that is dominated by men, they are still in this, okay, laser focus, we need to be, you know, we need to aggressive, assertive, and, you know, just get shit done, this kind of thinking. And then now you the collaborative, the empathetic, let's talk it out, let's be, you know, let's also don't only deliver the result at the end, but also deliver, also make sure that our people feel well. This is not appreciated, because that's not part of the deal. That does not turn into any hard bottom line or top line. This does not contribute to the hardcore KPI that men have set it up, because the workplace is still designed for men by men. Therefore, everything what you mentioned is considered as weak. And therefore, the collaborative nature or the empathetic nature or the feminine side of women, it's like an alien in the room.
Yeah, 100%. You know, what makes my blood boil as well, so I come out of the marketing industry and working in marketing, and there's two powerful forces in business. The first one is women. Culture goes where women goes. We know that. 85% of spending is influenced by women. Women are very powerful. We even know of FMCG companies that have been lobbying within government to make sure that women don't take maternity leave, so that they can make more money. The greed economy. Then if we look at marketing reflects change to enable it. So that's the mirror. It mirrors society, and marketing shapes culture. So with marketing and with women, I am really getting so concerned of what I'm seeing in the world, the wars, the power dynamics that are happening. And women need to start realizing how powerful they are. Because if we want to see change in this world, if we want to see a shift, I mean, like, if we just look at the campaign that is just launched in America with the jeans, the blue jeans, I can't remember the exact campaign, but I mean, marketing has such a big influence on women, and we as women really need to start paying attention to how we don't get the seat at the table, or we don't have our voices heard, or we don't get to make a lot of decisions in the boardrooms, but then we have another choice also in how we consume things. And that cognitive dissonance of buying things that is actually empowering people that don't have good intent, that don't honor you as a woman for who you are, but then they do honor the money that you spend and the money that you influence. What is your view on that?
Oh, this is a whole another topic. I mean, at the end of the day, I feel, you know, the beauty myths, you know, how women should look like, and a lot, the majority of the things, myself included, no, are we spend such an amount of money, energy, and time on being beautiful enough, on fixing ourselves again externally, whether it's through appearance or through makeup, through surgeries. I mean, the whole industry, as you just said, is targeting on women spending, and we are not even equally paid, no. I mean, we use the little money we made to consume the things to fix us that the patriarchy told us have to, you know, how you have to fix yourself. So I think this is a very long, tough topic, because, You know, if you grow up, I had read a study, don't nail me on the exact number, that there is no woman in the world, just no woman in the world could possibly feel, regardless how successful, how beautiful, how accomplished she is, to feel 100% proud and just good about herself. Because by the age of 18 today, a woman would have encountered, I think it was 10 million images, how the perfect woman should look
Sure,
like.
sure.
And you there will always be something that you don't fit in. In the Tang Dynasty in China, the more full-bodied women were perceived as beautiful. And then the next dynasty have said, oh no, the skinnier one. Then the next dynasty said, the one with the very small feet. Then the next one said the short hair, the long hair, the darker skin, the brighter skin. It's, you can never make it right.
Yeah.
Therefore, until women say, I am beautiful or accomplished about myself, and now I have never been more beautiful or more comfortable in my skin. Now, we will never change that narrative. And it's so tough because you have been fed decades of you are not enough. So it's not enough. It won't be enough until we internalize something else. We must start to change the script, the narrative ourselves.
100%. And it all comes from within, right? And how you view yourself and how you value yourself and break down that stereotypes and deprogramming yourself from the conditioning that you have faced. But I want to talk about something that's also very close to my heart. And this, I believe, will resonate with you because you have found yourself in leadership roles at board levels with very male-dominated industries. But also, you're not just you're a woman of color, different ethnicity, which comes with another set of challenges. So you are a few steps behind a woman because of these things. And I want to pull these stats and share it with our audience. But if we look at 60% women of color feel that they have to be on guard. They have to protect themselves against the bias facing emotional attacks. Now, emotional attacks is this mental burden, particularly marginalized groups. They continuously monitor their behavior, their appearance, and protect how they look and their hair styles and their language, their names, and how present themselves to the world. I think 75% of women face racism at work, racial slurs, microaggressions. 61% of women of color feel that they have to alter the way that they look, their identity, like as I said, their hairstyles and their language. And they even 28% of these women are also experiencing that they feel that they are being blocked for managerial positions. Talk me through your journey and how you have experienced working in male-dominated environments and how you've managed to create so much success. What did you have to change about yourself in order to be heard?
I think my experience probably very different than the majority, because I had a very good experience to be the only. Therefore, I can only tell from my perspective, and I think it's very unfair to a lot of stats what you have just shared. I think number one is that ignorance is bliss. I simply didn't know better. As in, I actually back then, this was 20, when I had my first promotion, from a manager to a senior manager, then to director. That happened in 2012. So I was, how old was I? Very young. And then I studied firstly industrial engineering, which is very few women and very few Asian women. So I was would study, and very few successful actually graduated from that study and then dare to make that move. I didn't think that was a disadvantage. I thought my thinking was now all this old white man, because commercial vehicle, very heavy metal industry, very old and white, and finally now the Asian beautiful Chinese person is gonna enter. How lucky are they? This was my thinking. I didn't know, oh, you could face,
I
because you're the
love that.
only, you could face difficulties. Because of that, now in hindsight, I didn't hear a lot of things, microaggression, sexism. I think I didn't hear them. In hindsight, there were a lot. Some are saying, oh, the aggressive Asian, aggressive, the dragon lady is coming in again, or you know, the empty drum beats the loudest, and there are so many. And then of course, because she has to bring the whole Chinese family back to Germany, that's why she's so aggressive on making money. I thought, oh, what a compliment. Yes, I do. I do want to make China richer. If I earn a lot of money, I'm going to bring all my relatives here. You know, it's just so many. It's just whatever has come in my way, I didn't understand that's a threat or there's something bad. I remember there was a conversation where the I was global marketing director already, and then the global R&D, a old white man, very arrogant. I mean, he's known for his arrogancy just in general. And then he said, Mrs. Liu, you know, one day when you are at my age understand the culture norm in Germany enough, you will understand why we have been successful and the Chinese haven't. And especially why women don't have a place at the table, and there was a reason, because you just, you know, because you are more inferior, more or less, just historically. And back then, it was very, very rude how he said it. I only recognized this because afterward, the people come to me, oh, it's really good how you responded. I will tell you, you respond in a minute. And I wish I would have, that courage and so on and so forth. I only recognized then it was rude, because after he said that, I was like, exactly. You know, I understand. That's why I am here. Because there are so many others' perspective, you know, they need a different perspective, because otherwise there was no quota, there was no any incentive to bring more women, more diversity back then. And then I was like, why would he even think that I did not deserve the place at the table? And I was like, but sure. I'm here for a reason, because the CEO actually gave me the mandate. So we are peers. I understand that you have much more, I appreciate you have many more years experience, but we are on the same job role. So I actually don't understand what do you want me to respond that comment?
Sure.
Because I really didn't understand. And he actually had no words, because the comment he made is just to make me feel bad, but I didn't feel bad because I didn't understand. You know, but everyone else understood, but they could not see through my lens. And I think there are many, many these moments. Instead of pushing back, the ignorance actually helped me, because I had one goal. And I think that's something, if anyone would ask me, how do you, you know, how really to make it there? It's just to ignore all the noise. My goal when I came to the company, when the HR was like, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And I said, I don't know. But I want to be the first Chinese female CEO in a DAX registered company in Germany. Wow. So you tell me where I need to be in 5 years. And and I meant it, because I always want, I don't know why, but back then I always want to be the most powerful. I want to give the Asian women the stage, which I see I don't see them in Germany, in Europe back then. I see some of them in English speaking country, but not here. So I just want to be that person. And therefore, every move I made, or every promotion, or every time we have performance review, it has always been that goal. So everyone else, if they want to attack me or make me feel bad, they couldn't, because I'm going to be the first female CEO in the DAX registered company. I mean, in hindsight now, I think it was very naive, no? But the naivety also helped you to progress.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very different perspective, and I really applaud you for being so honest about it, because, like, sometimes ignorance is bliss. Like, sometimes, you know, because women are very resilient, we know that.
Yeah.
But one thing that you're touching on that also really fascinates me, I'm also a very ambitious woman. I know what I want, and once I know what I want, I am so tenacious. But yeah. I do see a lot of women feeling that it's something to be ashamed of. Do not be too ambitious. Don't show that you're ambitious. What is your advice to women around the mindset around ambition?
I think this is where we stand in our own ways. Because who said that? Because this is a natural, everything what you just said. Now, I'm not discrediting that. And but has anybody ever told you saying, Carmen, don't be too ambitious, not good for you? Someone did say that to me, and because he said you should settle down and have children, and I said why? Because I want to understand. Because I just don't see the point. I have children now, but back then I said, why shouldn't I be ambitious? And he said, because you know it's very tough there. You have to work long hours, and then you have to, you know, you have to merge yourself with all these white men, and then someone's gonna take advantage of you, and then all these men later on they will have a family because they usually have a wife stay at home taking care of their family. They go back to someone. Who do you go back to because you spend all your time in the corporate world? And then back then I think I was 31. I said, I will do that when I was 35. And because it's and then he said, oh, okay, but then it's not that when you are 35, you're gonna find a husband. You have to go out, put yourself out there. And then I said, how do you know? Do you have experience, you know, when you are 31 and going out and you could only find your wife at 35? You know, a lot of things I think people say it, they don't even necessarily have bad intention. They just don't know better either. So the best thing is that you actually challenge them back with questions. With the thing what you just said with women being ambitious, whoever said you should not be so ambitious? Is that statement true actually? Or is it just a narrative that is around there? Has anybody actually told you should not be so ambitious? Let's say they have. What is their intention? In which context did she or he said that? Understand that, because sometimes it could be your own family, because they want you to, you know, they want you to be happy because they think the happiness is to have a settled family. Then you can negate that. You say, for me, at this stage of my life, that's not gonna bring me happiness. And don't, and then people say, yeah, but this is for your future. In future, I might be dead. I might be hit by a car today. So what matters to me is now. I think to understand where this narrative coming from and where do you stand is very, very important. A lot of things, there's dialogue and monologue that we hear. These are all noises.
I totally appreciate that. I think, you know, we're a very matriarchal country here in South Africa, and women play a very important role within South Africa, and especially in Africa. I think that it's also a lot to do with the perception of family, where you can and can't be, and that obviously moves into the corporate world because people have a certain perspective. To move back to the emotional tax, and where people feel that they need to change themselves in order to fit in. And we are having a lot of this conversations in our own community is a lot of women are feeling, I'm tired of showing up as a man the whole time. I'm tired of having to be, that I can't be my authentic self, who I really want to be. One lady in our community said it so well. I feel like I'm carrying this invisible handbag. There's only certain parts of my personality that I can bring out depending on what room I'm in. And emotional tax, when you feel like you can't be yourself and that you have to alter yourself, is detrimental to organizations because in the age of artificial intelligence, we need to focus on our authentic intelligence. And if we can't bring our authentic selves in leadership and how we show up, this is a big problem for organizations because when you show up, studies have shown when you have authentic leadership and people are more authentic and feel safe with psychological safety, organizations are more innovative. They adapt to change better. They are more cohesive. The culture is more supportive of one another. And I feel that I really am concerned about what I'm seeing within these toxic workplaces, not embracing authenticity, but almost like this, it's not said out loud, but there's just this known thing, you can't be this person in this room right now. You just can't show up as your authentic self. What is your view on that?
But what does your authentic self even mean? You know, because I think I want to challenge that as well. Because a lot of women say, oh, you know, it's very easy to deem a workplace as toxic. Because in the moment where you blame the toxic workplace, I can't be myself, you are putting the criticism or anything that is not in your control there. So that's a big victim mindset. I'm not denying, I think a lot of culture, you know, a corporate or tech startup, they are not good. But for some reason, you chose to be there. So to a certain extent, you have to play the role. But What does authentic self mean to you? For whoever asked that question said, you know, I cannot be my authentic self. I will ask a question. Okay, what exactly? What part of you could you not bring into that conversation?
Yeah,
elaborate for me.
Yeah,
you know, is it because I can't cry in the meeting? Obviously, that's not helping anyone, right? What does authentic? Which aspect do you think that is does not fit into the narrative? Because it's very easy to say I cannot be authentic. For example, let's take example. Someone said, I am usually a loud and bold person, but if I sit in a room full of men and they don't take me seriously because I'm too loud, too bold, then my question is, can you convey your message in a tone that the message lands, but without bang, you know, on the door? Because at the end of the day, you want to convey your message. That's your authentic self. But how you say it does matter. So is there a way that you can fit that in, but still get your message across? You know, or because...
I love that you're saying that because there's different types of authenticity, right? So I'm going to share four with you. So the one is rigid authenticity. And rigid authenticity is when you don't do the work on yourself, you just think, I can just show up biased and who I am, I refuse to change, and this is how who I am. And that authenticity is a very dangerous authenticity. You then have aspirational authenticity, which is my favorite one, which is I am showing up as the person I want to be. So if I want to be the CEO of next company, I am already acting as I am in that role in the most authentic version of myself, also checking on myself, my biases, and how I view the world. But then there's also contextual authenticity, where you know that your authenticity needs to shape and shift as you are in different rooms. So what you can say, what is appropriate for this room, but still... Every person must know that when they're dealing with you in every room, who you are. You know what I mean? Like, this is your personality. Yeah. And then there's obviously the conscious authenticity, which is like taking down the layers, taking down the masks, know who I am, what is my values, what do I stand for? And that authenticity for me is the crux of who you are as a person and really doing the work on yourself and having the courage to do the work on yourself because a lot of people don't have the courage. So I think it all depends on how you view authenticity and what it means to you personally, but it's definitely, you know, the types that are out there. So I want to talk to you about something else. Oh, it's got so many notes that I've got so many things to share with you. Okay, so the world has become very political, right? Do politics, and we've always been told, don't talk about religion, don't talk about politics, and don't talk about money. And being quite obedient about that. And now we are in a world where we have to start understanding politics, whether we like it or not, because in the boardrooms, we have to make decisions on geopolitics, because that is influencing everything about business. And I want to talk about politics. How do women navigate politics? What advice can you give women on navigating politics? Why is it so important to not shy away from politics, but actually embracing it?
Which politics are you referring to? Are you referring to the biggest?
I think all types of it, whether it's political, geopolitics, or whether it's politics in the workplace, we've got to be more courageous around it.
Yeah, I think workplace politics, that's something, a topic that I'm quite passionate about. And I think I have came very far in the corporate world because I was playing the workplace politics. And I think that's also a term that, as you rightfully said, women will shy away immediately because they associate workplace politics with, you know, backstabbing, with understand who has influence, with, you know, with doing all, understand all this informal network. And I think that's something that women are just generally not good at. Because again, going back to the tribe stage, we just want to get things done. And then especially for a woman who has two children to pick up with, she does not have in the meeting have the time to, you know, to throw words and then to play the ping pong. She just want to get the things done and then go home and pick up the kids. Therefore, we actually ignore and don't spend enough time to understand, for example, what does the shadow organization look like in the organization. Often the CEO have no saying, it's the CFO. Often someone reports to you, has a better relationship with the VP, so you want to have a better relationship with that person as well. There are a lot of, you know, a lot of things that are not tangible, and women firstly don't want to spend time on it because they think that don't deliver tangible results. And then secondly, we also don't want to spend time, you know, in the conversation that happened in the bar, the conversation that happened in the golf, you know, in the golf course where you have to, you know, the informal network. But in order to progress, I encourage women to think workplace politics in a very different angle. Firstly, how much do you want to progress? Because if you really want to rise to the top, you have to understand all these elements. There is no, this is a non-negotiable, so pick your battle. And then number two, reframe workplace politics, because workplace politics, if you let, especially women, explain, what does it mean? What's the word you associate with? Mostly women will say some negative words. But workplace politics is no different than to understand how to get things done faster through whom. If you put it in that way, to understand the context, you will make your move very differently as well. And I think that's the thing, that in the moment where people, women think, oh, politics, oh, I'm not good in, you know, in rephrasing my words, I just want to say who I am, going back to what you said with authenticity, it has nothing to do with that. It's actually, how do you help yourself to progress in the workplace through who? Or you want to get a project done, you want to, there are a competing project, you want to get approval of yours, who do you have to be friends with, or who do you don't want to be ally with, who has to sponsor you, all these informal things. It's actually more about that.
And it's being good at diplomacy, right? Yes. Making diplomacy your best friend.
In a way, and I think women are actually good in diplomacy. Women are good in collaborating, in creating win-win situation, because the ego compared to a man is just much less. Therefore, you actually want to create environment or things that, you know, that's beneficial for the team, beneficial for the company. You are actually in a very good position to play politics, you know, if you don't associate a negative connotation with it.
So I can't have this conversation without bringing up the Queen Bee syndrome, right? And this is I was at the University of Pretoria last week, where we had a full day with women in STEM, and the common theme that came up is there's a different kind of PhD that is surfacing everywhere, and it's pull her down. And I would like to rephrase it as pull her dreams. Why don't we pull her dreams into our room? Why do we not try and keep the door open and consider her dreams and make opportunity for women, that we can have more women in leadership? But the problem is, because there's so much scarcity, when women get into boards, they close the door for other women. And this whole conversation around lift as you rise, I mean, like, we have very big conversations here, especially within Women's Month, around why does Women's Month, Women's Day, only happen a certain part of the year? Why is it only a campaign or an incentive and not structural changes that are happening so that we can advance women? But then to close the gender gap, women need to be supportive of one another, because otherwise we're working against the tide. What is your view on that?
I think I want to give the Queen Bee also a bit of credit, because it's, especially in corporate setting, in male-dominated industries, it's actually very difficult to rise as a woman. A lot of women has to sacrifice a lot. Let it be family, let it be their own self, let it be things that they wish they would have, the challenge there is, as you rightfully said, because it's scarce, why should I lift up other? Because there were no women lifting me up as well. You can't blame them, because if you put yourself in their head, they have sacrificed usually everything. These are the queen bees I recognize. They have sacrificed everything what they treasure, appreciate to be there. Why should they lift up anybody? They also don't necessarily lift up men. And the challenge is why they don't lift up women is because often they rise into the position. It's not because other women help her. It's because other men help her. And then she can be the special one, the queen bee. Again, there's only one queen. And I think this scarcity mindset is also ingrained in our, you know, in our in our in the society, you know, that you see some soap operas that there's almost women fighting for small things, fighting for husband, fighting for whatever. So it's actually you it's very difficult for queen bee to change the mindset. The only way actually to change that is to have more queen bees. You need to have, let's say there are 12 seats at the table, and there's only one seat reserved for women. Of course, the scarcity mindset is going to kick in. The same is for men. No? Assuming there are 11 women, there's only one man. That man is going to protect the hell out of his seat either. So it's not a gender issue. So how I would reframe that is actually to help women. For whoever woman say the queen bee, she does not live out, she does not do this, she does not do that, but she must have done something right. So study that person. Study what has she done. You know, what has she done differently to rise? What did she have sacrifices? Or study that person like a Bible. And then you can make a decision then whether you want to go down that path. And if you go down that path, what opportunity would you open? You know, and therefore I think the more of us have the seat at the table, the less queen bee syndrome it will be.
100%. And I love how you approach that is, because I had a previous podcast where we were talking about, the flight, fight, or freeze mentality. Actually, women have something different, and psychologists are really having big debates around this, is that women tend and befriend when they face fear. And I think that this is why community amongst women and sisterhood is so important, because there we can hold each other accountable. There we can say, hey, this is not good behavior. How can we support you? But also knowing that we shouldn't be gossiping about each other, but rather just saying, okay, right, let's address this issue. This is not sitting well with me. How can we change this? But also studying one another and saying, okay, right, you've got some very good skills over there. I wouldn't do it this way exactly, but let me take it, the parts that sit well with me, and actually apply it in my day-to-day, and rather than resenting. And I think that that is such a powerful way of looking at it.
Yeah, but that's also the only way. There is no workaround, and that because there are so few seats reserved for us, then study them, and then the more of us are there, the more you open up the possibility to broaden the table at the end.
So I want to touch on influence and personal branding. So we did a research study about a year and a half ago with over 200 women, and we asked them how do they feel about personal branding. Now, I'm giving you the results. I'm not shaming it, but what was happening was women were saying mostly, I think it was over 80% of women that said they prefer that other women sponsor them or name them in the room when they're not there. But they don't want to take the onus on themselves to put their own personal brands out there because they're not comfortable with it. And I feel that is such a contradiction, because if you're ambitious, you want to be seen, you want to be out in the world. If you have a personal brand, if you build your thought leadership, if you build your influence like you do, you are brilliant at it. But you're putting yourself out there so that people can actually see what you're all about. And if you that your words speak for yourself when you're not in the room, that your name comes up as a solution to a problem when you're not in the room. Because if we have to rely on other people to pull us up the whole time, I mean, surely we need to have the courage to do it for ourselves.
This is a tough topic, because I think there are a lot of cultural conditioning just inside. You know, we are bringing, I mean, one thing that we have seen across, we've worked with so many women across the world, and regardless of where they are from, they have always been taught, you know, let work speak for yourself, you know, don't brag, and that's a contradiction with personal branding. They also are taught, you know, in our upbringing, you know, to care for others, don't brag about yourself. I think that's a very deep conditioning, a culture conditioning, culture as in gender conditioning. I don't know actually anywhere part of the world. Thank God things are changing in my generation. So I'm a kid of 1984, and that we have been told to, you know, to brag about your work, not to be humble. Let the work, it's always the let the work speak for itself, not let Jingjing speak about her work. So I think the only way to overcome that for women is actually to see the bigger cause. As in, firstly, if I don't speak of myself, nobody else will. That's just the law. And it's just get rid of your ego, because a lot of women are thinking, oh, what if I place myself and put myself out there, what are others gonna think about you? I can tell you freaking nothing. Whether you say something about yourself or not saying something about yourself, nobody is gonna thinking anything about you at the end of the day. So you better put yourself out there then, because if you don't, nothing will happen. First of all, if you do, someone might heard it, and then you are actually helping them to building memory structures to, you know, to memorize that. You know, I have always been there are a lot of bad mouthing behind my back when I was in corporate world, or saying, you know, that the empty drum, is the loudest, and you name it. I don't even remember all those words, but I always have a bigger calling, because I want to be the first female Chinese CEO in the DAX registered company back in Germany. If you have a bigger calling or bigger impact ahead of you, all these things, you will just be quite ignorant. And I think that's also something that the likability trap, women want to be liked and respected at the same time. And sometimes in this world, when it comes to P&L and power, sometimes you have to choose one. I rarely know a lot of women. They are very, very likable. Like, oh, the Hello Kitty, you love them. They have power. They don't, because you don't even necessarily respect them in that thing, because they do things for everybody and everyone. So I think the personal branding things, that if you don't speak for yourself, who else? And that's the only way to, and if you get yourself out there, only when you get to the position of power and influence, you can pull up another woman. And then, and that's sometimes my problem with sisterhood, is that, oh, let's all cuddle collective. Sometimes we throw a question, you know, in some of the circle, saying this happened to me. People are like, oh, you didn't deserve that. Women are not they are champion for each other. But this just on surface level, because none of them have power. Nobody can pull anybody up, because they are all, you know, under the radar.
Sure.
So let some rise and then pull up. So you have to put yourself out there. Let the world to know the good work or the brilliance you do, but not only for you. So you can rise to the position of power and influence. Mm-hmm. Then you could pull off the others. I think you reframe that. You are not doing this for you, your personal branding. You are doing this for the sisterhood, like you said. And I think then the calling and the mission become very different.
Yeah. And I also believe I'm very big on thought leadership. I also believe thought leadership is not something that just happens overnight. It's something that comes slow. You work on it, you research it, and you keep on building it on it. And it's not about visibility. It's more about your body of work that brings value. And when your body of work brings value, then yes, it's a very different thing. And I think that this is one of the most important things. Nobody teaches people, you know, like, I'm going to give you an example. So let's look at women in STEM. Right, there's maybe only say 30% of women, they complete their degrees, they go into the workforce, and then they don't have brands, and they don't build their brands in their career. Then they reach their 40s, reinvent their lives, and they've spent all this amazing time working in powerful organizations and not speaking up and speaking out, and then they want to make a change, and they've never built their own personal brands for these big career reinvention stages that happens in life. And I think that's also for us as older generation, is to look at the younger ones and say, you leave, you graduate, you're a graduate, now you start promoting yourself from this moment onwards. And I think that there's also a lot of generational gatekeeping that happens that prevents women from growing, you know, to become successful. And we should start this with a very young generation. I always tell our youth board, I always say to them, you're not the future leader. You are already leading. We can't talk to the young people like they are going to be a leader in the future. They're leading because there's younger generations looking up to them already, their nieces, their cousins, etc. So in your view, if we look at, you know, if we look at generational gatekeeping, how do you find that that is diminishing the work that we're trying to drive for progress?
When you say generation gatekeeping, you mean the older generation don't let younger generation rise?
Hmm? Yeah.
I have to say, I haven't experienced that a lot, probably. Therefore, I can't talk about that. And then I think the only way is to, for younger generation, especially when you have a deeper calling or because I think the good thing you experience young generation, they don't just want to write, they want to associate with a bigger good, bigger with a bigger calling as well. It's actually to study the older generation, how they have rise to power and why they think this way, approach them with understanding. And otherwise, I always feel that there is this maternal fight, you know, within women, the younger generation, older generation. Women are so good in building sisterhood, but we actually don't build a alliance that like men do, you know. You know, like sometimes what hurts me, I always have been in a very male dominated domain. What I see by men is that, you know, a man, they don't even necessarily have a relationship, but the manager in the lower rank, the manager has attended the event or asked the higher rank, the manager, to, you know, help him or to advocate for him. The higher rank manager don't even necessarily hesitate and then just do it, because I don't know whether it's because of their men, but because they have a certain code among, you know, we help each other. Whereas women, I think we hear a lot of our sisterhood and generations, you know, let's come together. Women are so good. We can spend the whole day. But next day, when push comes to shove, the one woman going to push the other woman down to the heel. This is part of the things I feel that, you know, that there's certain trauma or certain generation scarcity inside that we need to break that. And in order to break that, you have to, one person has to stand up and say, okay, where is this coming from? You know, you're not supporting me. And then let's study, let's give the appreciation, let's speak the language, let's go one step instead of putting that person just in a basket.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's a complex issue, and it's definitely something that we need to address, because it does stand in the way of progress. But also, everybody's responsible for themselves. I think that is important. But I don't think that you need to step on people and you know, destroy people on the way up, but leave the ladder so that people can climb up. I think that it's very, very important. And especially in the times that we are living in, if we want to see change in the world, if we want to see policy change, if we want to see structural changes, we have to come together as women, because we influence the wallet and how money is spent. And if you look here in South Africa, most women we call have baby daddies, where they are taking care of their own children. It's the matriarchs that take care of the children. So mostly they are responsible for the expenditure here. So I think that it is very, very important also to use your influence in so many ways, but we have to come together. We have a thing here in South Africa called Stokvels. And Stokvels is where the women in communities, they all come together, and then they all put their money together for funeral policy, for groceries, and they put all their money together. Then they go to the banks and they say, hey, we have over 100 women. We've put our money together for 1 year. We want a better rate. And they start negotiating with all the large corporates. Over a 50 million rand industry here in South Africa. It's very huge. And they understand the power of money, and they understand the power of negotiation and coming together. And I think that that is something that I think Africa can teach the world around not being individualistic, but also to come together in unity. You know, if we look at some of the things that are happening, you know, on the political landscape, our world leaders, a lot of it has been inspired by South Africa, but they've taken inspiration from the wrong things. they should have taken inspiration from the amazing things that happens here. But, you know, we always treat it as a stepchild in the world, Africa. And that has to change, because it's really, really powerful leaders here. And I always say, because I've been around in 40 countries, talking on stages, doing my thing. And I've never seen enough women on the stages. And I'm on a mission to get Africa to the world and get them on stages, because we have to show the world how incredible these women are. We've got some of the best speakers in the world, but they're hidden behind algorithms, because algorithms don't serve, you know, our world as much as it does for the developed countries. But anyway, I'm ranting. I just want to say it has been such an honor to spend time with you. And I hope that I can have you back someday, maybe going deeper in one of these topics. But I want to find out, tell me a little bit about what you're up to. What's your next? How are you going to achieve your 5 million women? How far are you on that target? And, you know, what is percolating for Jingjin?
So I moved back to Germany. So we're going to extend the Elevate offering, and then everything what we do across the world. It has always been across the world. But initially, we want to actually help impact 5 million Asian women, which is not even 1% of anything. It's like a very small number if you look at that. And we also want to, and for me, moving back here is I want to see Asian women on global stage. And I think that's something that's very close to my heart, because if you look at like what you say, everything what you just said about African women, I have no clue, because South Africa is just so far away and then from the stage, and then people just don't pay enough attention. And I think same is for Asian women, and especially in non-English speaking countries like Germany, France, yes, and Europe. And I want to see more Asian women rise and then become, you know, become world leaders and then become influencers. And it does not need to be, because influence impacting 5 million women, what we said, is not, people associate with corporate power, with political power. A little girl, you know, help her mother and, you know, building the family and then helping her brother and helping others. This is also kind of leadership. We want to make sure that these women, this voice is being heard, and then that's the only way, is actually through money, through education. I love what you said about the African women, you know, putting money together, and I think that's sometimes, I think, what is missing in the female empowerment part, is that we don't put money where our mouth is. And I think that in a moment where money is involved, now you earn the place at the table. And it was net narrative, so going back to me, and then I want the world to see Asian women rise, and then because there are so many of us across the world, and there will be only more and more, and then, but we have been told to be timid, to be, you know, to be smaller, to be humble, to be, you know, to be less of who we are, and that needs to change. And so we're building the company here and extending the offer, and let the world to see how powerful women are, and that is about damn time.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I'm moving towards my 50s now, so I'm like, okay, I've had enough now. Enough now. Yes. I don't know, this is a switch that goes off in our minds when we reach this age. It's just like, I actually don't care. Right?
Yes.
My identity is not in pleasing anymore. I don't want to be that person. I want to say what I think and then, you know, listen. So I just want to say thank you so much. You're a powerful force, a Twitter force, and I love seeing your content, and keep going. We are big fans here in South Africa.
Thank you, Carmen.
As I mentioned to you before we got started, is, you know, in our WhatsApp groups and in our community, we're always sharing your content and debating it. I actually had a few of our allies that sent a few of your posts through and said, have you seen this? And I was like, that's very cool. they're getting with the program. Now that's a wrap. I'm always so blown away by the women that we bring on the show. I mean, I have just been completely blown away by the way that Jingjin has approached some of the topics, and this just goes to show how important these conversations are. So I just want to say thank you so much for sticking around, and see you soon. Bye-bye now.